you for extending to me an invitation to be a part of this. It has been a great couple of days. I appreciate so much the good work that everyone has done. My topic is, as Jim mentioned, a little bit unusual. It's not one that I had dealt with before. Is the teaching of Jesus on MDR part of Old Testament legislation? When I first saw Brother Dvorak yesterday, he came up to me and he said, "You know, Jim scheduled this a little off. He should have put yours first, because if the answer is yes, we don't have to have six more lectures." So I'm not going to answer it that way, though. So as we're going to deal with it, we'll look at this particular issue. As Jim mentioned, and as I mentioned, I had not been exposed to this very much. Maybe some of you all have, and I'd be curious to hear about your experiences. As I was working on this, I came to learn that it has come up a little bit in New Mexico, not far from where I live, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of its distribution later. This particular issue centers on the fact that there are four passages that we've talked about the last couple of days in which Jesus in the Gospels will address the subject of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and 32, Matthew 19, verses 1 through 12, Mark 10, 1 through 12, and both of these, as we'll talk about a little bit later, are in the same situation, and we have the account of both Gospels recording that. And then Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18. And the question comes, is Jesus laying down new law, or is Jesus simply commenting on Mosaic teaching? Now, what I'd like to do is go through, and we're just going to look at the text. Now, forgive me, because we have dealt with all of these texts extensively so far in our study, but I want to kind of just put them in perspective in terms of thinking about context and thinking about what we find. Matthew chapter 5, 32, of course, comes in the Sermon on the Mount, and it comes in the context of talking about adultery in the heart in verses 27 through 30, and before talking about a prohibition of oaths in chapter 5, verses 33 through 37. That may become significant to us, because I want us to consider the fact that when we are talking about marriage, as I mentioned in the comments, if marriage is a covenant, what we're talking about is, are we going to honor covenants that we have made? And I have put a little chart in your outline, and I would encourage you to follow along in the outline. I'm not going to deal with all the information that's in there, but there's detail in that that will supplement what we're talking about. And I have a little diagram there that kind of suggests what I think Jesus may be doing, in which he kind of interweaves the seventh, the ninth, and the tenth of the Ten Commandments. Now, is he then just simply commenting on those, or instead, is he asserting something new? The next text, Luke chapter 16 and verse 18, comes in either the midst of some random teaching or in response to the derision of the Pharisees back up in verse 14. Now, I say it's one of these two because that may affect a little bit how we understand it. If it's just several random teachings, we may not be able to relate certain things to this passage. However, if it is in response to the derision, what you find before this is back up in verse 15. You have Jesus commenting on God's view of the heart and wealth. Then, Brother Mark Dunnigan pointed out to me this, and if we are talking about something that's a flow in response to their derision, this is an interesting text, because he makes the statement there in verse 16 that the law and the prophets were until John, but since then the kingdom is being preached. And that becomes significant, because that may well show that when he moves on to talk about that the law won't fail, and then the marriage divorce statement, and of course rich man and Lazarus, that may just give us kind of an indication he's talking about things that now are part of the kingdom. The two that probably we spend the most amount of time on are Matthew chapter 19, verses 1 through 9, and Mark chapter 10, verses 1 through 12. And this, of course, comes from a discussion in which the Pharisees ask him some questions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. It is very likely that they are trying to bait him in to see what view he holds. We know from rabbinical writing. We know from the Talmud that there were different schools of thought. You had Shammai that would argue that it could only be for sexual immorality. You'd have Hillel that would say it could be for other reasons. A first century commentator would even go so far as to say, if you became more attracted to another woman, she no longer had favor in your eyes, and so you could put her away. They may want Jesus to comment on that. And as a result of that, we see the following accounts. Now, I have a little chart in the handout that I would ask you to take a look at, because there I lay these two passages side by side. And I think it's important for us to kind of notice some distinctions about these. Sometimes you'll have questions about, well, now why does one put the exception clause and the other one doesn't? And they'll treat it as if there's a contradiction. But sometimes I think what they don't note is that in Matthew records an element of the question that Mark, the Holy Spirit, doesn't lead him to record, and that is this element, for just any reason. And I think that may well be why it is Matthew that then will record the element of Jesus' answer that addresses exactly what the cause is. Now, with that said, Mark has something interesting, because while Mark does not record that element of the question or that element of the answer to the Pharisees, a lot of times we miss the fact that what he does say in verses 10 through 12 is not in the same context of the discussion with the Pharisees. But you'll notice that it says, in the house, he talked to them about that. And there I think what we'll see is Jesus emphasizing the principle he wants Christians to understand, and that is the permanence of marriage. Now, Matthew will also record something that happens after this that Mark does not. And it's a little unclear if that was a part of the discussion in the house or if it's still there when the Pharisees are there. But this text on eunuchs. Let's go and look at each of these. And I intended to read through some of these as we're going along. Let's catch up a little bit. Go back to Matthew chapter 5, verse 31 and 32. Matthew chapter 5. Verse 31 and 32. And our question is Jesus just commenting on Mosaic law? Now, in two of these we're going to see, there's no question that he uses that at least as a springboard for his discussion. But let's look at it. Matthew 5, verse 31. Therefore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Now, you'll notice here he's referencing Mosaic law and what has been said. I ask you to notice, and we're going to comment on this a little bit later, that as he contrasts this, it's in the midst of several antitheses where he'll say, you've heard this, or this has been what's said. He then will assert, but I say to you. Now, keep that in mind. Look over in Luke chapter 16. In Luke chapter 16, this text that I mentioned is either random or is in the midst of a response to their derision. What do we notice here? Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced from her husband commits adultery. No exception clause. You have here the basic principle that Christians need to understand. You honor your marriage vows. Go to Matthew chapter 19 now. And let's notice just the first part of this, and then we're going to compare some things with Matthew chapter 19, and we'll look just at verses 1 through 9. And you know, we've talked about these so much, I feel a little redundant in some ways, but we got to remember the context and everything it said. Verse 1, Matthew chapter 19. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these sayings that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. Now, you might note from the chart that's in your handout that is where Mark ends the discussion with the Pharisees. That's the answer that Mark records to their question. Can a man divorce his wife? Jesus says, what God's joined together, let not man separate. Continue, verse 7. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. Now, that content down through verse 8 is also recorded in Mark. Mark will place it kind of a little differently before what God has joined together, let not man separate. But Mark does not have this, verse 9. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Now, remember, why would Mark not put that? Because Mark didn't record the element for any cause. And so Matthew addresses that element with that element of the question. Now, or of the answer. Hold your place here and go to Mark chapter 10. But I want us to notice in Mark chapter 10, this discussion that takes place in the house with his disciples. And notice the wording here. Verse 10, and we'll go down to verse 12. In the house, his disciples also asked him again about the same matter. So notice it's a different occasion. It's a different situation. So he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, a couple things about this. First of all, the exception's not there, but we've already talked about that, haven't we? Mark didn't feel compelled or feel led by the Holy Spirit to address that part of the question. But notice something else that's different. Here you'll see Mark addressing the fact that Jesus applied it equally to the woman as well. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Now, go back to Matthew chapter 19 for a moment. And let's see this part of Matthew chapter 19 and the part of the discussion that Matthew deals with after the situation with the Pharisees. Because you'll notice there, verse 10, and this is something we talked about in the discussion period. The word that's used up at the beginning of the chapter for just any reason is the word that in the original here will be used again in verse 10. His disciples said to him, if such is the case, they realize how he's answered this. And that's one reason I can't take the view that it's not dealing with what's the appropriate cause for putting away as well as for remarriage. But notice they say, if such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry. They realize the serious nature of this. Verse 11. And he said to them, all cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. Now, a lot of times in our discussions about this, we stop at either verse 9 or verse 10, and we don't recognize that this section as well is a part of Jesus' teaching on MDR, because he is responding to what circumstances may result from the very teachings he's just laid down. Notice what he says, verse 12. For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it. Now, this is not talking about vows of celibacy like our Catholic friends would argue. Instead, it is talking about those that either recognize, I can't meet the terms of marriage, so I'm not going to get married to begin with, or recognize because of what Jesus has taught, I'm not free to marry. I'm not free to be in that situation. So that's what he's describing here as making themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Now, our question really also has to look at what do the Mosaic laws teach about this? Because if we're going to argue that all Jesus is doing is commenting on Mosaic law, then we need to understand what Mosaic law taught. And there's one text that at least in three of the scriptures we've looked at so far, Jesus has referenced. And that is Deuteronomy chapter 24. I'd ask you to turn in your Bibles there, and we're going to read it in just a moment. What's the context of this particular passage? Well, Deuteronomy chapter 24 will come in the context of discussing honoring vows made before the Lord. Very similar to what we see in the Sermon on the Mount. This is an issue of honesty. Are you going to keep your word? It also comes in the context of respect for a neighbor's property. And then it'll go on after Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. 4 to talk about military exemption for newlyweds. Now let's go to this text and let's read it together, because this is probably the most explicit text that will deal with the subject of MDR, and it's one about which there was the most debate. It's not the only one. It's not the only one we're going to talk about, but let's look at it. Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce. Remember Matthew 5, Matthew 19, Mark 10. That was brought up in each of these. Writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. When she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, notice this, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving to you as an inheritance. Sometimes I think mistakenly folks have looked at this and they've thought, he just allowed divorce for any kind of circumstance. I hope we will see as we progress in this lesson that that's not a good way to look at this. Because in a similar way to polygamy that we'll talk about a little bit later, I do believe that Mosaic law gave some allowance or some provision for some things that were already going on. But if you look really closely at the nature of this law, does it really encourage a man, you divorce your wife whenever you want to? Or instead, is it laying down some terms that will make it clear if you do that, and if you do it just thoughtlessly, you may put her in a circumstance in which you can never take her back? And I want us to understand that, because I think that's very serious. Very quickly, I want us to deal with a few others that fit into this equation. Deuteronomy chapter 22, in verse 18 and in verse 29, we have two laws concerning sexual sins. The first one that we want to notice is there in verse 19. A man who falsely accused a woman of not being a virgin when they married, if the accusation was true, she was to be put to death. If it was false, he was to stay married to her and could never divorce her. Similar text over in verse 29. One who lay with an unbetrothed virgin, whether it is the sense of consensual or some kind of violation, a very similar kind of term. He's to pay a fine, and he could never divorce her. There are some terms under Mosaic law in which divorce was not even an option. Over in Leviticus chapter 2, verse 7 and verse 14, in the midst of laws governing priests, we see that priests and high priests could only marry virgins. They could not marry, quote, a widow or a divorced woman or a defiled woman or a harlot. Now, we'll see why that may be significant a little bit later, but I want you to notice here, Mosaic law taught that if fornication took place, if adultery took place, there was to be capital punishment. However, I want us to notice that in some of these we're going to see right here, there seems to be the acknowledgement that you will have some divorced women among you. Now, that either means that they didn't punish every adultery, or there was some divorce that took place not for adultery, not for sexual immorality. Another one over in Leviticus chapter 22, verse 13. They're in the midst of laws governing the eating of the holy offering in the home of a priest. In a similar way, a priest's widowed or divorced daughter who had returned to his home with no child could eat of it. Again, acknowledging there would be divorced women in Israel. Numbers chapter 30 and verse 9, laws governing vows made by women and some of the rights and responsibilities either of husbands or fathers. What do you do in a circumstance in which a woman who is a widow or a woman who is a divorced woman makes a vow? Is she responsible for it herself? Yes, she is responsible for it. Again, acknowledging there will be those divorced women among the Israelite community. The last one I want to note, and I really, we're not going to take the time to read it, but in the course of our discussion, this is a pivotal passage that answers the argument of those that will try to say Mosaic law equals the law of Christ equals patriarchal law. Because that argument essentially has to say that what Jesus was teaching is exactly the same as Deuteronomy 24. But over in Exodus chapter 21 and verse 11, you have laws pertaining to an Israelite woman who would be sold into slavery. Now, we mentioned yesterday, sometimes some of these laws, you kind of look at them, it's kind of icky. This is one of those that is that way. A man could betroth himself to a Israelite woman that had been sold into slavery. And he could then, if he chose to, take another woman as a second wife. Now that addresses the issue of polygamy. Was it allowed? Was it tolerated? Here, it's tolerated. However, he could only do that as long as he did not diminish her food, her clothing, or his marital rights to her. If he did diminish those things, the text tells us that she could go out free without a finding of uncleanness such as what is described in Deuteronomy chapter 24. Now that's the text. I want us to lay these side by side and kind of consider some things about how they compare. Because if, as this argument holds, law of Christ in the Gospels is simply commenting on Mosaic law, well, how does that really work? Let's ask a few different questions. First of all, who could initiate a divorce? We touched on this some yesterday. Only the man could put away his wife in Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. In your outline, you'll notice a few quotes from Josephus that demonstrates first century Jewish thought on that. You'll also see from the Jewish encyclopedia, Jewish authorities acknowledge that. They'll look to Exodus 21 and see that as kind of a germ of the beginning of the thought that a woman could do it. And certainly there were women that did it, whether they had the right to or not. Herodias, for example, and another relative of Herod is quoted there. But that was their understanding of Mosaic law. Unlike that, Mark chapter 16, as we noticed in verse 12, Jesus applies marriage laws equally to the man and to the woman. What about another question? What about what constitutes adultery? And we've had a good discussion about that. One of the things that I would challenge us to think about with that is, under Mosaic law, adultery was defined as sex between parties married to someone else. And you might note these passages because I think there that documents this primary definition. Now, there is somewhat of an exception that somebody might throw out there from the book of Hosea, where there it will speak of adultery after a putting away has taken place. However, given the nature of the way in which the book of Hosea is talking about God and Gomer, and kind of interchangeably talking about spiritual adultery, that may not constitute an actual redefinition of adultery. My point is that under Mosaic law, adultery is not counted as post-divorce remarriage. Remember, Deuteronomy chapter 24, it doesn't say if he gives her a certificate of divorce, sends her out of his house, she marries someone else, she's an adulteress. No, she's not counted as an adulteress. Now, we've got to contrast that with what Jesus says in the Gospels. Jesus expands or extends the definition of divorce, in my judgment, to include not only what can take place while you're still in a marriage covenant, but even when that covenant has been broken and you are outside of that covenant, you've been put away and you remarry someone else, he calls that adultery. I think we've got to see that as a major difference between the law of Christ and the law of Moses. What about the issue of what is a lawful cause for divorce? Now, this argument says they're the same. But let's look carefully at this. We noticed in Deuteronomy 24, this word that's translated some uncleanness in the King James, New King James. American Standard would put it an unseemly thing. New American Standard, English Standard will put it some indecency. It is the Hebrew phrase erva dabar, which literally means a nakedness thing. Now, advocates of this view will zero in on that and say, the same way the Mosaic law would talk about uncovering nakedness as a figure of talking about actual sexual immorality, that must be what this is talking about. Well, I don't think that quite follows. It seems to be some type of indecent behavior that is short of adultery. And the reason I say that is because Mosaic law, whether you're talking about the betrothed woman that they find she wasn't a virgin when they got married, she was to be put to death. Or in a case where there's adultery that takes place, she's to be put to death, even the one that she committed adultery with. So I think we have to concede this is a little something different. And if it wasn't that way, why would there even be debates about it among the rabbinical schools? Contrast that with Matthew chapter 5, verse 32. In Matthew chapter 19, verse 9, that word porneia, that is translated fornication, seems to describe sexual immorality in general. Now, we've had some good discussion about how far we can take that. I generally will understand it in the sense of a distinct type of sin from covetousness. However, I recognize that there can be certain kinds of things in which one is granting a level of intimacy to another person, even if they can't touch them, that only properly belongs to the mate. But Jesus lays down here a clear, identifiable threshold. You know, I may not be able to know what's in someone else's mind, but I can see what they do. And when this happens, that's what Jesus says is the cause. I think we've got to see these as different things. Now, we'll come back to that a little bit later, perhaps. What about the issue of reconciliation? Here's a major issue I want us to think about as well, because remember, Deuteronomy chapter 24 taught that it was an abomination before the Lord for a woman that was put away and remarried. If she then was put away again, that first husband could never take her back. That was described as an abomination before the Lord. Now, we contrast that with what we've noticed several times already this morning, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 11, where there, the woman who has been separated from her husband, she's either to remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And there's no qualification. There's no prohibition that's a part of that. And I think we have to recognize that as a significant difference. What about this issue of certification? You know, we kind of hear that and we don't think too much about that. But Mosaic law taught very clearly that a woman had to be provided with a certificate of divorce. And I don't know that I really understood this very clearly until some study that I'd done in recent years, but I think it has become very clear that to give a woman a certificate of divorce in ancient times in general, particularly in the first century, would have been essentially to sanction her right to divorce. I included in the handout an example of the wording of a Jewish certificate of divorce from AD 72. It's written in Aramaic and the translation is provided there. But you'll notice particularly in that certificate of divorce, near the end it says, you are free on your part to marry any Jewish man that you choose. Does that help us perhaps understand anything about what Matthew 5:32 meant when it describes, if you divorce her except for sexual immorality, you cause her to commit adultery? If you put something in her hand that says you're free to remarry, you are contributing to her adultery, as Jesus defines it. Now, the New Testament, interestingly enough, offers no real law or provision about the providing of a certificate of divorce. I think perhaps that's because the principle that Jesus is teaching is the permanence of marriage essentially will make a divorce certificate obsolete. In the cases in which there is the right to put away, then I think the different laws that are governing different areas would certainly apply to that. But I think that's an interesting difference. We're not seeing something there that giving a certificate of divorce is viewed as a fulfilling a law before God under the teaching of Christ. We notice these passages that dealt with priests and divorced women, and we may have thought, well, how does that really pertain to our argument? Notice a few things. First of all, remember, only priests and high priests were forbidden from marrying divorced women. Now, not including the exception, how does that compare with Jesus' teaching? Well, if Jesus defines divorce and remarriage in general as adultery, can we engage in adultery and be right with God? No. So essentially, again, excluding the exception for fornication, Jesus is essentially prohibiting marriage to divorced women for all who are his people. And again, with the exception clause accepted there. The issue of the marriage of priests. You remember a priest and a high priest could only marry virgins under the law of Christ. It is not restated for the holy priesthood of believers that make up all who are priests in Christ, offering up spiritual sacrifices to God. Under the law of Moses, what about this issue of polygamy? Well, we notice that there is allowance and protection in which it mandates that there are a certain behavior, certain kinds of protections that are to go on. I think this would include a number of passages, particularly the one that we talked about there with the man who had a Israelite slave that he betrothed himself to. There, it doesn't say you can't then take another wife. It allows him to take another wife, but there's protections. In the same way, some of the laws pertaining to Levirate marriage that we're going to deal with in just a second, that teaching of if your brother dies without having children, you are to take his wife and to raise up children. Now, in the event that you're already married, that would be a mandate for taking a second wife unless you went through a certain procedure. Now, what about the law of Christ? Well, I want you to notice that in Matthew chapter 19 and in Mark chapter 10, and actually even in Ephesians chapter 5, when there is a quote of this important passage in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, all of the New Testament examples where this passage is quoted, a different form is used than is probably in most of our translations. The Hebrew Masoretic text, which is the standard kind of text that has developed over the centuries and was kind of crystallized, the earliest copies that we have date to about the year 900 or so, they are what most of our English translations look to for the translation of the Old Testament. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, it does not read, the two shall become one flesh. It reads, they shall become one flesh. But why is it that Jesus and Paul would use that form of Genesis 2, 24? I think there's pretty good evidence to suggest that in the first century, that was a reading in the Hebrew text. And why would I say that? Well, for a few reasons. Number one, the Samaritan Pentateuch will put it, the two shall become one flesh. The Septuagint will read, the two shall become one flesh. Even the Jerusalem Targum, which is a paraphrase of the Hebrew that is very ancient, would say, they both shall become one flesh. The Latin Vulgate will put it, the two shall become one flesh. Now, if you're familiar with the fact that in the 1940s, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls brought back an example of the Hebrew text to the first century, even earlier, the fact that there were many biblical texts within the Dead Sea Scrolls allowed us to test that. And while there's a remarkable amount of consistency, and it verified the accuracy of the Hebrew text, there are some occasions in which we'll see the Septuagint may be more accurate or some things like that. Now, unfortunately, we can't answer this question with the Dead Sea Scrolls, because the portions of Genesis that would have had that are either damaged or missing that particular section. But I want us to notice that Jesus doesn't use a form of this that would grant allowance for more than one wife. And I offered some examples in your outline of some early Christian writers that perhaps commenting on this very thing, they acknowledged that the pattern at creation was not many shall become one flesh. Instead, it was two. In fact, I like a quote from Tertullian where he said, you know, man had a whole lot more ribs, but God chose one rib for man. And I think that's important. Let's think a little bit about this issue of Levirate marriage, because, again, a brother, if he didn't do the procedure that's outlined, had to take that. But under the new covenant, under the law of Christ, this is not restated. And this definition of marriage, the two shall become one flesh, would preclude Levirate marriage. Just a few final things with this. Divorce and false accusation. Remember, if you made a false accusation, you could never divorce. This is not restated under Christ. The issue as well of divorce as a result of sexual assault or even consensual circumstance in which you could never divorce her, that's not restated under the law of Christ. And I want us to notice as well this issue of eunuchs. And we may think, well, talking about MDR, why does eunuchs fit into this? Remember that section in Matthew chapter 19.
after the disciples say, if that's the case, it's better not to marry. And Jesus says, some, for the kingdom of heaven's sake, will choose not to marry. Now, let's think about that as we compare Mosaic law and law of Christ. Under Mosaic law, a eunuch could not offer sacrifices or enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, isn't it interesting that not only do we have prophecy that Isaiah would prophesy a time in which the eunuch will no longer be excluded from the assembly of Israel, but then in the book of Acts, one of the examples of conversion is one who is a eunuch. So whether you're talking about one who's a eunuch physically or one who has made him or herself a eunuch for the kingdom of heaven's sake, they're no longer excluded. Now, our assignment is to deal with this one covenant theory, this argument that will argue that you are talking about simply Jesus commenting on Mosaic law. As I began looking into this, I found that it's a little bit like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. They hold a lot of different kinds of views. However, I think it's pretty consistent that many will put it this way. They'll argue Jesus wasn't laying down new law. One fellow says he was simply a Jew teaching Jews how to be good Jews. Now, again, there are many different variants of this, but let me just in a nutshell offer to you what they'll basically argue. Number one, from Adam to Christ, there has been a consistent universal moral law that has been in place. They'll look to Romans chapter 5, in which there it will talk about sin before Mosaic law is given, and they'll argue, okay, see, it must have been this type of universal moral law. We'll talk about that in a minute. Some will speak of this as an act of revelation, but others will describe it as something that is instinctual, and they'll look to Romans chapter 2, verses 14 through 15. Some brethren would extend this even to the present and say that the principles of the gospel, moral principles of the gospel, still are a part of that universal moral law. Second, they will argue that Mosaic law prohibited divorce except for fornication. Here's an irony about this view. They actually will argue divorce under any circumstances has always been sinful. However, if you are divorced, we'll see here in a minute, they'll say you can stay in that situation. Now, they'll go on, though, to say that some uncleanness in Deuteronomy chapter 24 should be equated with adultery. They'll say they are the same thing, and they will argue that Jesus is just commenting on that principle. They will also argue, thirdly, that although there were unique ceremonial laws, the moral teachings that were a part of this universal moral law have been in place from the beginning. They will argue, fourthly, that in the Gospels, Jesus is commenting on the Jews' faulty interpretation of Mosaic law. He is not laying down new law, but simply enforcing Mosaic law, which they believe reflects this universal moral law. It's interesting, we talked a little bit about how we understand this term hardness of hearts, and or hardness of your hearts, and they have an interesting take on this, because they will not argue that it is either hardness towards God or hardness towards marriage. They will actually argue that what it's talking about is the man's hardness in being unwilling to forgive his adulterous wife. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. Fifthly, they'll argue that properly, the fullness of gospel teaching on MDR is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But they will again say, it's not really new. It is simply reinforcing the moral law that has been in place from the beginning. And they will zero in on these phrases here. It is better to marry than to burn, and let each one remain in the calling in which he was called. And they will essentially argue that, yes, all divorce is sin, but it's better to marry than to burn. So if you have remarried, you stay in that marriage. You are to remain in the calling in which you were called. Now, I want you to really think about this. This was touched on a little bit in a couple of the previous lectures this morning. But I think this is a real challenge if you encounter folks that hold this view. They are calm in their explanation of it, but I want you to think about the ramifications of this. Because they will argue that since Paul taught that forbidding marriage is among 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, doctrines of demons, they will then argue that those like myself and perhaps many of you here that have taught that there are circumstances under which it's improper to marry or to remain in a married condition. Since the law of Moses taught that it was an abomination to be reconciled back to a first mate, they will actually argue that those of us that would teach reconciliation with the first mate are practicing doctrines of demons and teaching that which is an abomination before the Lord. Now, we need to answer this. We need to see if we can address this. Now, it was interesting because as I was researching this, and again, I wasn't that familiar with it, this term one, what's that?
10 minutes.
One covenant doctrine. That is not a term that all of the folks that advocate this will apply to their understanding of this. And I think it's important if we are using terminology, we've got to distinguish this from what's known as covenant theology. Covenant theology is a denominational teaching that basically argues there have been different covenants throughout biblical history, and it stands in contrast to dispensationalism. And this is different. Fortunately, this is a view that has not had a lot of widespread influence. I put in your outline some of the advocates of this. It has largely been up in the northwest of the United States and some in the Philippines. And I put in your bibliography sources for those that have countered it, those that are advocates of it, and you can look at it. Well, very quickly, I think in our time we can get through this because I'm just going to hit it kind of in a cursory manner. Universal moral law. I believe we've got to concede that there has always been law. And that's true because of one of the texts they will look to, Romans chapter 5, verse 13. Sin is not imputed where there is no law. Romans chapter 4, verse 15, where there is no law, there is no transgression. The issue is, what was the nature of that law? Now, I think as we think about this, Genesis chapter 3 and verse 22, after sin comes, we'll describe, the man has now become like one of us to know good and evil. We have it within us to be able to distinguish good and evil. But that's something that must be taught. This is not instinct. Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23, O Lord, I know that the way of man is not himself. It is not a man who walks to direct his own steps. I think there has always been accountability before God. But go with me to Romans chapter 1, and I want us to notice several things that Romans chapter 1 offers, because I really think it kind of helps answer this whole issue. How is it that there has been an accountability before God? Remember, in Romans chapter 1, verse 19 here, says that God has shown, the Hebrew word phanero'o here, to make manifest or visible or known what has been hidden. He has done that to the world so that they may know things about God. All right. How do they know that? Well, he goes on to say, his eternal power and Godhead are made known, verse 20, by the things that have been made. Okay, advocates would say, see, it's you can look at the world and you can know things about God. Well, we can know some things about God. Notice it goes on to say, they knew God, verse 21, and yet changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like animals and things such as that. Now, think with me about that. Can I look at the things that are made in the world around me and go, you know, God doesn't look like a bird or a four-footed animal, and I can change that? No, I don't believe so. Notice further, we can see here in Romans chapter 1, they exchange the truth of God for a lie. Truth. Remember what Jesus will say in John chapter 17 and verse 17. Your word is truth. Is that a hint that we're talking about revelation? I think further, they chose not to retain God in their knowledge, chapter 1, verse 28, and knowing the righteous judgment of God that those who practice such things are deserving of death. Can any one of us look at the world around us and, or even from our instinct or what's inside us, go, you know, if I sin, I really deserve to die? I don't think we can. I don't think one of us can do that. Notice, clearly God has spoken in time past about his will. And I think that just meshes with Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 1. I put in your notes a little picture and some little examples. I find it interesting that in some of the earliest laws that have been found, they try to say, God gave this to me. A God gave this to me. Now, I'm not saying that Code of Hammurabi really came from God, but I think that may reflect some recognition that deity at some time in the past spoke and revealed his will. Marriage law. I think it's important for us to recognize that, yes, some principles seem common throughout all periods, but moral concepts pertaining to MDR and other things have clearly changed during periods of different dealings with man. This side of the cross, John chapter 12, we're not going to be judged on the day of judgment by the Mosaic law or by the patriarchal law. Jesus says his words will be what judge us on the day of judgment. Now, with that said, we need to understand there is no separate moral law to which the world is accountable prior to baptism. That goes to Bruce's lecture yesterday, but there's some overlap in what these folks will hold and what Bruce had to address as well. Now, with that said, let's think about this argument that they pose. Is divorce under all circumstances under Mosaic law counted as sin? If so, we need to recognize that there are some instances in which God had commanded divorce. It is my judgment that the very first recorded example of divorce is that of Abraham sending away Hagar. I recognize that this is something in which Sarah said, cast out the bondwoman, but God then says, you go ahead and do that. And from everything we can understand about that, that was a sending away. That was a putting away. In the example of Mosaic law, we notice there, Exodus 21, verse 11, if you're not going to give food, water, and marriage rights to your Israelite servant that you betrothed yourself to, you can send her free. That is a divorce without sin. We can see as well in the days of Ezra. You remember those circumstances. Under Mosaic law, you were prohibited from marrying those of pagan nations. When those after the exile realized they had done that, it is at the command of God that they were to put away their pagan wives. So we can't argue that divorce under all circumstances under the Old Testament was sin. Now, we don't really know what specific laws pertaining to MDR were during the patriarchal period. We have a few clues, perhaps. We know premarital sex was a disgraceful thing that ought not be done, Genesis 34, verse 7. We know adultery was something, at least adultery within that Old Testament definition, was something that was a sin against God. But polygamy and concubinage are not described in that same way. Jesus' teaching, based on what we see in that Matthew chapter 19, verse 8, seemed to be restoring the original intent that God had at creation. And I think that applies both to issues related to MDR and issues related to polygamy. Mosaic law, while it did give provisions for MDR and polygamy, these, as we've talked about, I think properly considered, were to protect the woman. They were to curb these practices until in Christ it is restored as it was at the beginning. To equate all of these demands that we ignore a lot of details that I think are very important in this discussion. One of the things that I think advocates of this view just completely ignore is the force of Jesus' statement here, what God has joined together, let not man separate, both in Matthew and in Mark. If in lawful marriage, as Malachi 2 points out, God acts as witness, and then God makes one those who enter into a covenant, you're talking about something in which God is the one that joins them. God does not join or make one those that are in marriages that have been prohibited. I think that's important for us to understand. If God has not joined them, it is not forbidding marriage to urge people to leave those unlawful unions. Think about, again, Ezra. And here's some of the wording from Ezra chapter 10, verse 11. They were to make confession, do his will, separate yourselves from the pagan wives. John the Baptist. Was John the Baptist teaching a doctrine of demons when he told Herod and Herodias, it is not lawful for you to have her? No. In unlawful marriage, you're not talking about something that is forbidding marriage to do that. Is the teaching of Christ new law? Genesis chapter 49, remember, there was the prophecy that the Messiah would be a lawgiver. Jeremiah chapter 31 teaches that the new covenant would proclaim laws written upon the heart. Mosaic law, and not merely the debt of sin, but Mosaic law, came to an end at the cross. It is nailed to the cross. Romans chapter 10, Christ is the end of the law. I think we've got to recognize that Israel was commanded to wait for that new prophet like Moses And what did it say there in Deuteronomy chapter 18? They were to hear him. I mentioned this wording that we find in Matthew chapter 5:32, but also throughout Sermon on the Mount and probably elsewhere as well, where Jesus will say, "I say to you." You know, some of the scholars will say that's one reason that probably Jesus' teaching was viewed as something with authority. He didn't teach like the others did by saying, "Well, Rabbi so-and-so says this." He said, "I say to you." In that, he is asserting a new teaching. He went about already teaching the kingdom, as Matthew chapter 4, verse 23 indicates to us. Can I just finish up? I'm almost done. Or you want me to finish it?
No, please, go ahead.
Okay. All right. I think we need to recognize as well in Acts chapter 15, verse 5, you remember there one of the errors of the Judaizing teachers was that they were urging disciples to keep the law of Moses. If there is only one law, why would that be wrong? And I think we need to recognize that. If there was no new law, could Christ act as our high priest? That's the point the Hebrew writer will make in Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 12. Clearly, Jesus brought a new standard of law which now holds all people accountable. This issue of moral versus ceremonial law, I think, is really an artificial distinction. And if you think with me about that, God expects obedience to all aspects of his will, whatever the time and whatever the laws that are being offered. Jesus will quote, "Man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord," in the giving of the law in Deuteronomy chapter 8 there. "Every commandment which I give, you must be careful to observe." Mosaic and patriarchal law didn't have things like baptism, didn't have things like the Lord's Supper, nor were they the same in their teaching on MDR. And I think we've got to recognize that that doesn't, as these folks will say, make God a respecter of persons. Instead, it is God at various times and in various ways speaking by the prophets. Now, if you want, I can end this part during question and answer, or I can go ahead, whatever your preference. Okay, all right. The last thing I have, and it'll just take a second, is the force of 1 Corinthians 7. I want to tell you, I think this is one of their most odd arguments. Because think with me about that. If they are saying that, well, 1 Corinthians 7 is properly teaching to Christians, but Jesus was teaching Jews in the Gospels about Mosaic law, well, think with me about what they've said. If patriarchal law equals Mosaic law equals the law of Christ on MDR, wouldn't you be saying the same thing regardless of whatever audience you're talking to? I don't think that follows. How are we to understand in 1 Corinthians 7? And we talked a good deal about that today, but let me just offer a few things. I think it is important for us to recognize you cannot mesh 1 Corinthians 7 with Mosaic law. And that's true for a few reasons. First of all, unqualified encouragement to post-divorce reconciliation. That didn't work. That's different from Mosaic law. Also, marriage to an unbeliever. That doesn't work if you're going to say it's the same as Mosaic law. Also, a lifelong bond to a husband. I've often wondered there in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39, and in Romans 7, what law is being referred to. I think we've got to recognize it is talking about the law of Christ. Because Deuteronomy 24 did not consider it a lifelong bond when a man sent his wife away and she remarried another. And yet under Christ, it is a lifelong bond. So these things just don't mesh. These are not the same law. Paul's teachings were Christ's teachings. You're not talking about something in which they conflict with one another. And that's really, it kind of aggravates me when folks will try to take that position, because it's almost as if you're the argument that some will say, well, let's follow the red letters in the Bible. No, you know, they are the same. And we recognize that from a statement Paul will make in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 37. The things which I teach are the commandments of the Lord. The Holy Spirit was promised to come upon the apostles and to give them things that Jesus had not taught while he was upon the earth. The apostles' doctrine and the doctrine of Christ are one and the same. So with that said, I think what you see is a fuller explanation of Jesus' teachings and inspired revelation on what had not been addressed. In that "not I but the Lord" section, I think all that is dealing with the ramifications of what Jesus taught while he was upon earth. The I, not the Lord section, it's not something in which he's just telling his own opinion. He is giving inspired revelation about matters Jesus had not specifically addressed, such as unbelievers, such as the present distress, such as widows, and that kind of thing. Well, what about these two arguments they make, these two statements? How do we understand that? And I really think context solves the whole thing. Do these allow one to remain in any marriage, regardless of the conditions? Well, that first one, remember, it's in Paul's discussion of sexual responsibilities within marriage and his preference that people stay unmarried. It is not talking about unlawful kinds of marriages. He'll make a similar point down in verses 36 through 37 concerning virgins. But it's not saying that any kind of marriage is better than burning with passion. He's talking about those that have the right to marry. In the same way, let each one remain in the calling in which he's called. He has just made the statement to the one who's married to an unbeliever, let him not divorce her, let her not divorce him. And then he offers these illustrations. He compares some things that they may not be the preferable state. I'd rather be free than be a slave. Different perspective. Maybe I wish I was circumcised, or maybe I wish I was uncircumcised. Either way, he's talking about things that are not sinful, but they may not be preferable situations. He's not dealing with that which is unlawful. I want to just finally offer, if this doctrine is correct, how could we properly ever argue against homosexual marriage? Now, advocates of this position would say, well, homosexual marriage was never something that God sanctioned. And I would agree with that. But to get that conclusion, we'd have to look outside of 1 Corinthians 7, wouldn't we, to make that conclusion? Now, if we can do that for homosexuality, why can't we look at what Jesus taught in the Gospels and recognize that we must mesh what Jesus taught in the Gospels with what Paul taught in 1 Corinthians chapter 7? Thank you.
10 minutes, guys. We've got plenty of time. We'll get you out of here early.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's in recent months, I've heard a couple of different times from some fellow brothers that there is no new law.
Oh, wow.
And that was really good.
Thank you.
So I'm looking forward to going back and reviewing that.
Thank you.
That was really good.
Thank you, sir.
Very good.
Thank you.